Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 17th of July. Several years ago, we interviewed a gentleman about Postville, Iowa. It was a fascinating look at a town in Iowa, a small town that really had done some remarkable things to revitalize its economy. They welcomed people to come and work from other countries. And so this story caught our attention a while ago, and today we present it to you on the air. On May 12th, nearly 400 undocumented workers were seized by federal agents at the agriprocessor's kosher plant in Postville, Iowa. They were mostly from Guatemala and from Mexico. Men, women were arrested as serious criminals, 260, and they were arrested for using false Social Security numbers. Most were sentenced to 5 months in prison. Attorneys say, immigration attorneys, that a wait of 6 months is not unusual in prison, and if a person decides to fight deportation, it could take years. Undocumented workers were making $5 per hour below minimum wage, and a supervisor made a side business of selling the workers used vehicles, sometimes threatening them with the loss of their job if they didn't purchase one. There have been problems for the whole town as a result of this raid. Writers have said it has devastated the town. Postville welcomed immigrants over many years as city officials were eager to reverse a declining population and to revitalize its economic development. Now it's much as it was 20 years ago. More than one in six persons arrested in this town. Businesses are suffering, and nearly everyone, immigrant and non-immigrant alike, affected. Is there money available for the women and children who are on monitoring devices and waiting for their criminal and immigration hearings? There are problems with getting enough basic goods like food, housing, and baby formula. And everybody is very concerned that the federal agents will return, and who knows when or if. We have three guests with us to talk about this story, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We have two guests with us at the very start of the show. Jens Manuel Krogstad is a staff writer for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, who's been covering this story for quite some time. Jens, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Also joining us is David Vasquez. He is campus pastor at Luther College and is quickly learning the law to provide legal advice for those who have been arrested and for those who are in jail. David, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you. And just one clarification, I do not provide legal advice, but I am coordinating the legal response with some of the lawyers in the area.
Okay. Let's start with you, Jens. Give us a background of what exactly happened on May 12th.
Well, May 12th was the largest single-site raid in history of the United States,
really?
Actually.
Really? My.
They arrested 390 workers, I believe, in a town of about less than 3,000, I know, and they came in with dozens of federal agents. There was helicopters, armed agents raiding the plant. I mean, it was a huge deal. And they had set up a temporary court. They shifted almost the entire district court, which is located in Cedar Rapids, 45 minutes away from Waterloo. They set it up in Waterloo, a town about an hour and a half south of Postville, and that's where they took all the workers by busload after busload.
And, David, the workers had been in Postville, I understand, for quite some time. Many of them had been working at this plant for years.
Yeah, they have been, you know, all of these folks have been part of this community. Postville has often been hailed as an ideal kind of community in terms of immigration, as people that came here settled here with families, and they've been here for a very long time. It varied in degrees, of course, by worker, how long they've been here, anywhere up to 15 years, and some fairly recent. In fact, some that were detained at the raid had only arrived over the weekend before the raid.
Oh, my.
And we're at the plant, actually not even working yet, but beginning to look for work, and we're detained in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody have any idea that this was coming, Jens?
Yeah, the speculation started after we wrote a story about 10 days before the raid about the presence of ICE agents, Immigration Customs Enforcement agents, in Waterloo. They were tight-lipped about what they were doing, but just by their very presence, people started to think there'd be a raid somewhere. They didn't know when or where. And it turned out about 10 days later that they did do a raid. And actually, the day before the raid, there was a big meeting after Mass at the Catholic Church in Waterloo, where they have Hispanic ministries, where they went over the legal rights of illegal immigrants. And it was attended by hundreds of people. And it turned out to be very prescient.
Mm-hmm. And they are charged with pretty serious offenses here. Some newspapers, including the New York Times, have said that the charges are quite harsh, David.
Yes, they are. You know, one of the issues here is the criminalization of this. I mean, raids, as you said, you know, was there a sense that this was coming? Raids have been happening across the country. There was one 2 days ago in Austin and Bedford. So it's a policy change and shift in the last couple of years to use this. And one of the shifts in this particular raid, and it's significant concern as to why this was done in this particular place, that raises some significant issues in criminalization of the process. There is a separate system for people who, you know, oftentimes when people refer to immigrants as illegal immigrants, one of the things that's important to distinguish is that the charges they were charged with do not have nothing to do with immigration. They have, most of these folks have not yet faced immigration charges. And they will do that, but there was a combination of some of those charges together with criminal charges that have to do with identity theft. Many of them were charged immediately. The warrant stores them were for aggravated ID theft. And so there's a lot of questions about whether that was the right kind of accusation to use towards them. Is it appropriate to be doing that? Was the law created and intended for this kind of prosecution of aggravated ID theft? Did the workers knowingly use these documents? Did they know they had somebody else's ID in terms of their Social Security? So some of the issues have to do with the fact that they were, if you look at the list of people who were charged, of the 389 detained, 270 of them have received 5 months prison terms. These come out of pleas that they were offered. And the issue is that they were given a plea that if they plead guilty, they would get 5 months in prison. If they didn't accept the plea, they would wait 6 to 8 months, is what many of them were told, at least from their own reports, that they would need to wait 6 to 8 months for a trial and then be facing possibly 2 years in prison because of the kind of charges that were being brought against them. Many of these folks did not even understand what a Social Security number is. Of the ones who were charged enough for pleas, if the number they were using happened to match the existing number of someone else,
mm-hmm.
an existing number, then they were given a tougher sentence. If it didn't, they basically were then deported or placed into deportation proceedings immediately mm-hmm. without receiving a sentence. So the concern is, in some ways, this seems fairly random as to whether the number they were using happened to match or not. And then in the plea agreement, they were pleading to a lesser charge that carries a maximum sentence of 6 months, and they were all given 5 months. So it's hard to understand how this is a favorable plea. You know, if a judge had made the decision individually per case, they could have decided whether they could give 0 to 6 months to the individual for this charge they were pleading to, and across the board they were given 5 months. Some have longer sentences because of prior immigration issues.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I think it's important to note that this had never happened before, that not only had there never been this many people arrested at once in a raid, but also there hadn't been this many people arrested on criminal charges and thrown in jail. And there's, like David said, one of the charges is knowingly using Social Security number to defraud someone. And knowingly, it's possible they might have been found not guilty, like if they would have gone to trial, because one of the attorney immigration judges I talked to said that she gave me the story that sounded outlandish, but she said it was true that when they paid a coyote to cross the Mexican border, they were told by the coyote, when you cross the border, someone's going to stop you and give you these papers, and those will be your work papers.
Oh.
Well, those people who stopped them were federal agents who gave them court documents, legal papers. And, I mean, just kind of that mentality where you think, how can these people possibly be that gullible? And, I mean, that. But if they're told this, they'll believe it.
Right.
Well, and that is exactly, and this is not outlandish in the fact that this is the story for many of them. You know, one of the important things in this case is we're talking about, native Guatemalans, the majority of them, 300 of the detainees, about 297 are from Guatemala. The majority of them are from very small communities, and they paid upwards of $10,000
per
person to a smuggler, basically, to get them here without really understanding what they're doing. Many of them are not necessarily knowingly even thinking that they think they're actually, you know, oftentimes the way that these smugglers present themselves is as if they're arranging for them to travel to the U.S. because they recognize there is a need for labor. And so their understanding sometimes is that they are coming with work permits. They walk for 2 months to get to the border. And when they get there, they're told basically, as you have indicated there, that they can walk up to the border and that arrangements have been made for them to get a permit. So they receive those papers thinking they have a permit. They're released because what they get is a notice to appear. And then they remain in the country thinking oftentimes that they have some kind of documentation. What they most of them feel bad about is that they think their permit was only for 3 months and they overstayed it.
I see.
You know, so that's when they were asked, you know, to plead guilty, they thought, oh yeah, you know, I overstayed. I was only given 3 months.
Mm-hmm. There's a big human side to this as well in terms of what's happened to the town of Postville and what's happened in terms of families, not only those who live in Postville, the women and the children. Some women are wearing monitoring devices because they were arrested as well. And also the amount of money that might be going back to Guatemala and to Mexico. I would imagine there are many people who are in prison or still on monitoring devices who are terribly concerned about where the next meal is coming from or may be coming from for their families.
That is the daily heartbreak. I mean, to see, you know, I think that the question for those of us who are supporting here the effort, you know, our question is not necessarily to say, you know, there should no immigration laws or enforcement of them. It's just a question as to whether this is the way to do it. I mean, does it make sense to take people who are hardworking, who are working 12 to 14 hours a day and work that is very demanding? Does it make sense to come into their workplace and deport a fifth of the town and take them away from their families and convert these people from hardworking, generating for the community here and into people who are, you know, just without any resources, and like you have pointed out, their connection personally here to their families immediately here who they support, but also to their families back home. All of these folks, when you consider what they have done to come to this place, have made a very difficult decision in coming. They don't desire necessarily to leave their family and friends and everything that's familiar to them. They do so out of desperation and huge need. Now they are going back to that desperation and need, but in the process, even most of them are asking, you know, If we have no options in immigration, let's go, let us go. Let us return to our home countries. Let us be reunited with our families.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have that pressing concern. The reason that many of the people who are serving sentences accepted the pleas is because in their mind was their children and their grandmother at home or their mother at home in Guatemala or in Mexico for whom they need to provide. And they thought, I cannot sit here for 6 to 8 months for a trial and then be facing 2 years. Even if my rights, you know, I don't understand them, or if I could have a better option, I just have to go the shorter route. And if 5 months is what they're offering me, I'll take it so I can be back producing and providing
right
for my family.
Jens, the town of Postville, which we have talked about before a few years ago when that marvelous book was written about Postville, has been described as an unusual place welcoming immigrants over a lot of years. The city officials were trying to revitalize the economic development, and it has really hit the community, I understand, in a pretty tough way. Tell me how Postville has responded to this raid.
Well, they responded really the best they could was just and really kind of cross your fingers and hope that your businesses will survive. And next big question is the school year. How many kids are going to be in school? I mean, the education district there, they rely on money per pupil there. And if they don't have as many kids as they had last year, they're going to have severe funding cuts. And as far as the businesses, all of them said they had a cut in sales, and the ones who focus on Hispanic clientele say that they could be going out of business sometime this summer. That business has just dropped off since the raid.
Mm-hmm.
I know some of the landlords in town had vacancy rates of 70-80% immediately after the raid. They had to try to freeze their loans to not go out of business. And, well, the huge part of the effort was actually, by the church, where David has been working a lot. They've been spending thousands and thousands of dollars to care for some of the people. There's about 40-plus women in town who were arrested and released to be able to care for their children, but they are staying in town. They can't leave the state of Iowa, but they can't work. And they're actually being held there. They're being held until they can testify to a grand jury, according to an attorney, an immigration attorney I talked to a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it costs a lot of money to support dozens of women and their children.
And if I can interject for a second, one other point about these folks who are in the community, there's 42 women and 3 men who are released on humanitarian reasons to be with their families, plus about 20 minors who were released under similar circumstances who were working at the factory. For all of these folks, what they are waiting for, of all of them, only 2 women have actually received a notice to appear so far, because it's 2 months after the raid. So most of them are in incredible limbo about how long this will take and what charges they're up against, because they have not yet been charged. There's a lot of reasons for that, but some of it is just the need and urgency for this limbo, to end, and because the community cannot afford to be providing for these folks. And these are very hardworking people who aren't willing to take. They're not looking for handouts. Of all of the people in need, many are coming to the church in desperation, but most of them are trying to figure out how to survive, how to provide, and are terribly embarrassed to have to ask for help.
Right. If this meatpacking plant has been operating for so many years, why did this raid happen right now? Obviously, been using undocumented workers for a number of years. Why did they do it on May 12th?
From what I understand, they started investigating agriprocessors. By they, I mean ICE and the federal government started investigating agriprocessors about a year and a half ago based on a tip. But you're right. They have a long, long history of workplace violations. There have been amputations. There have been serious injuries there that have been documented by OSHA just in the past few years. And in congressional testimony this spring, they highlighted agriprocessors in Little Postville, Iowa, as one of the 3 worst plants for workplace safety in the country.
Hmm.
So, and I think the reason they raided it was not because of those workplace safety violations. And one other thing was a child labor investigation by the state, too, which was held up temporarily because of the raid.
And that's one of the concerns, is that, the rationale for the raid in this place, and now I think it's laudable in the sense of saying, that there needs to be awareness and enforcement of both immigration law and also labor laws. But the problem is that the process and the way in which these raids are done, it tend to have a counter effect to their intent, in that they do, disrupt investigations, ongoing investigations. Labor unions have been trying to, organize to bring charges against the company. The Department of Labor, the State Department of Labor, and the Federal Department of Labor have been involved in that as well. And, when you take the majority of the workforce out who have been victims and do not treat them as victims. That's the issue too here. And when people were detained, they were immediately treated as criminals, and the proceedings were so expedited and the criminal charges came so quickly and were just mass produced in a way that there was no time to look at the individuals as victims and say, what is your situation? Can you contribute to this investigation? Can you and benefit from that contribution as well? The immigration law as it is currently written allows for people who have been victims of crimes to at least, you know, for the sake of prosecuting criminals, you know, that are oppressing people or human trafficking, you know, the laws call for looking at individual cases and seeing who might be a victim rather than a criminal. And the way that this raid was processed and the criminal charges were done did not allow for that in the majority of the cases.
And one other thing that could, I think, is another big reason why they might have raided it finally was that agri-processors had been warned repeatedly since about 5 years ago that they had people working there who had Social Security numbers that didn't match the Social Security database. And they were given multiple letters, and apparently they didn't take action because according to the search warrant filed before the raid, it was something like 700 of the people working there had Social Security numbers that didn't match.
Oh, my.
So, I mean, they arrested 390, but there was another 300-plus that were working a different shift who weren't caught.
Exactly. And, you know, and one of the things in terms of the previous warnings to them, the actions they did take, at least according to the testimony, or just not testimony, but the conversations with people who have been affected, is that, you know, many of them were told, basically, your Social Security doesn't match, you need to come up with a new one. And it, rather than, you know, you're done with your work, I mean, they would normally be fired, but then rehired by the same person a couple of days later with a new name and no new Social Security number. And that's one of the issues when the criminal charges were brought. A large number of the Social Security numbers matched because over the last several months, people had been re-obtaining numbers. There's claims that some of these numbers came from the company itself or people within the company, and not necessarily the company, but within the company. And so that as these new numbers were given to them, then a higher percentage of them were actual matches.
Let's pause for a moment and welcome phone calls for both of our guests. Our guests are David Vasquez. He is campus pastor at Luther College and is coordinating the legal advice for those who were sent to prison and are facing serious criminal charges. Jens Manuel Krogstad is a staff writer for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier and has been covering this story ever since the undocumented workers were seized by federal agents at the agri-processors kosher plant in Postville, Iowa. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, a book that's been receiving a great deal of attention during its release this week. Jane Mayer will be with us, a Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting, author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. We go to phone calls now for our guest, Jens Manuel Krogstad, staff writer for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, and David Vasquez, who is campus pastor at Luther College. And start our calls with Mike from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. This raises a whole lot of questions. You talked a little bit about the enforcement of labor or the lack of enforcement of labor law and how these people were being exploited, paying less than minimum wage and so on. I've read a lot about how ICE was used, Immigration Naturalization Service, was used whenever there was threat of unionization in a plant, they would have a raid. And then they would scare people and scare the organizers away, and then they would these people would make their way back into the plant. But it was used as a way to keep unions out of the meatpacking plants. The other question I want to ask you is, where are these people serving their sentences? There's a lot of privatization of immigration jails, and to me this just sounds like a scam to make money for corporate prisons.
David, you want to take that?
Sure. You know, I can't comment too much about, you know, I think it's difficult to say that immigration is in some ways trying intentionally to, you know, to break up unions, but there's certainly that concern because of the patterns I have been seeing with some of the other raids, and I'm not as familiar with those. But I do know, you know, that I know that that's a concern that has been raised, and I think, you know, if you think of it in historical terms, here where we are in Decorah, I live in Decorah, just north of Poseville, we're about to celebrate Nordic Fest. You know, this celebrates immigrants from a previous generation, and I've been thinking as we have prepared for the celebration, what would it look like if we came across a document that documented a federal agency coming into one of these little towns early on in the 1800s or late 1800s. And took 400 of its residents away. I mean, in shackles. What would that look like? You know, some of the immigrants who were coming then. So I think that it raises the question about what is the role of a federal agency in these communities? You know, if there are labor violations, does it really trump some of the investigation going on against it? In terms of the second question that you know, that was raised about where people are being housed, again, these are not. People are not serving immigration charges. Most of them are not. 270 of them about are serving these criminal charges for identity theft. So those, they are actually under the care of the Board of Prisons. And this has been one of the very difficult work as a response team here locally, which we're talking about just volunteers and a handful of people here, tracking where people are. I mean, if a family member comes and asks where their brother, son, father is, we oftentimes can't tell them.
Really? You don't know where they are?
And we've contacted, we spend hours sometimes trying to find. There is no centralized place to identify the location of people, which complicates obtaining signatures for them for their U.S.-born citizen children when they're trying to get a passport, getting just a letter to them. So we have just basically two people that full-time track where people are, you know, and make calls to try to find where they're at. But they're all over the country now, serving their sentences. In Louisiana, it's a large group of people. Some of the women are being moved to Florida. Some have been in a private jail, also in Nebraska. And so a lot of them are in county jails. And so, and each of these places has a different procedure for getting letters to them or getting funds to them. So it's an overwhelming task.
Do they have lawyers, David?
Not really. I mean, you know, well, you know, this is the issue here. Because of the pleas that were given, you know, in the criminal charges, they had public defenders. But we're talking about each public defender had to represent 10 to 30 people in with a translator. And we have to recognize that many of these people do not have Spanish as their primary language. You know, they speak a different language from Guatemala for a lot of them. So the translation, it's, you know, layers of problems here. And so the lawyers are trying to represent 10 to 30 people, and they had 72 hours to do this. You know, in a period of a week, everybody had to accept their pleas. So this was very pressed, and that's when they had lawyers. Since then, the cases are done. They pleaded, and actually part of the plea is accepting immediate deportation. So they basically have no immigration case. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to obtain. I mean, the state will provide attorneys, public defenders for criminal charges, but there isn't such a thing in the immigration law, so they would have to have private attorneys. We've had a lot of different pro bono attorneys who are trying to help. The only ones that do have representation legally are those who were detained and then released, these folks who are kind of in limbo right now, because they have not signed a plea, they haven't been charged with a criminal charge, so they still have the opportunity to exercise their rights under immigration law. All of the other folks did not have that opportunity to actually even understand what possibilities they had for what is called an immigration remedy.
Right. Let's go to Karen from Lafayette County. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. I would just like to say that the packing plant owners, they should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. What they were doing to these people was totally wrong. But I'm on the other side of the issue where I had my identity and Social Security number stolen. And, excuse me, it's upsetting to me even today. I found out when I was notified by the IRS that supposedly I was earning money at some place that was like because I was able to look into it, a chicken processing plant in Mississippi and an orchard in Washington State. Of course, I had to prove to the IRS that that wasn't me. It was very difficult to go around doing it. I even had to reconfirm all my information to the Social Security office that I was who I was. So when people start using somebody else's identification, it costs a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of agony to try to get it cleared up. And to this day, I'm still dealing with that.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, illegal immigration is a terrible thing. There are lots of victims. I mean, victims like yourself, victims like the workers we've been talking about. I mean, for example, I talked to a 16-year-old in Postville who told me how she got a job. She said, I went there to the office to apply. They told me I needed to get a different Social Security number. They gave me a phone number to call, and I called that phone number, and they got me a number, and I went back to the office and started working. There's a lot of tendency to blame just the illegal immigrants, but they get a lot of help along the way to get where they are
it
working.
Sounds like it, yeah.
So I think it's important to remember that there are coyotes, there are businesses who are also complicit in illegal immigration.
Mm-hmm. Karen, thanks very much for the call. Carl from Peshtigo, hi. Hi, Carl. All right, Carl's no longer there. We go to Mohammed from Madison. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. I first became aware of this situation. My anthropology instructor, John Luke Matthews, who's originally from Korea, presented this in a movie about Postville, and it showed how these immigrants from Russia, mostly New York, by way of New York, if I said that correctly, came to this small town that was really kind of like on its last leg because the farming industry there had gone bust. And it showed how these people eventually sort of came together culturally, these Mexicans, individuals came to this town and started working at these plants. But as a consumer, I followed this lately because there have been two articles here in the Madison area, one talking about the price of kosher meat like everything
right.
else going up,
mm-hmm.
and then this full-page article. And it's, what struck me is, you know, for the past 30 years, I've patronized buying these kosher meats for the health of it, for my family. And then to find out, this, you know, that some of what I've been eating hasn't actually been you know, properly supervised the way you would think it would be in a Jewish establishment, just really hits you right in the gut,
mm-hmm.
Pun intended. The other thing that kind of bothers me is how the individuals who are doing this, who are running this business, seem to somewhat go unscathed. And I realize your focus is on the situation that's occurred with the undocumented workers being rounded up and the effect it's had on their families. But it just, how have the agribusiness people gone unscathed? And lastly, for individuals, Jewish individuals, who have gone through so much history of oppression and being abused, and we know all that history, how could they come back and treat people like this is what I'm wondering.
And they supply a great deal of the kosher meat to the country, so
yes.
there's another effect there, right? David?
Almost half, I think,
is
supplied by this particular operation.
Right. David, what about that?
Well, you know, there has been a lot of discussion within the Jewish community itself about, you know, the wrestling with this because of the large role that agri-processors played in their kosher market. And one of the concerns has to do with how do you define kosher? You know, and so that's an ongoing debate within the Jewish community itself. A couple of things I would say, you know, and I appreciate the caller's comments, is that we need to divide a couple of different issues as we think about this, the immigration law and then also the labor issues. You know, the immigration issues and labor issues can at some point be separated, although they're connected in the fact that immigration laws that do not allow for people to have a status then create an environment in which it is easy to take advantage of people. You know, and one of the concerns we have as organizers here and as people just, you know, trying to respond to one of the raids is, do the raids accomplish what they're set out to do? I mean, that's a question that I think we need to wrestle with as a nation. We need to enforce our laws, but does this actually enforce our laws? Because what it causes is panic that then doesn't, it sends people into hiding and it makes them more prone to exploitation and to situations like what we have seen. We need to remember that while this particular plant has specific issues of labor as well, that meatpacking as a whole industry is dominated by immigrant labor, and it always has in the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the immigrants have always done meatpacking. And so the day after the raid, to give you an example, in Waterloo, 70% of their labor force in one of the meatpacking plants was gone the next day after the raid.
Oh, my.
I mean, that ought to tell us something about who's cleaning our meat, whether kosher or not.
Right.
And so I think that we need to kind of maintain those concerns and realize that, you know, this panic that is created across the nation, you know, the concern about prosecuting the employers, even though that's one of the stated goals, the reality is that it's much more difficult to prosecute the employers. It's much easier to take these undocumented folks who don't understand their rights and prosecute them and catch them and, you know, in bandfuls of them.
Mm-hmm.
98% of the people who have suffered from the raids who have been charged are workers. Only a minute percentage of people and companies have received what many have called just, you know, small, insignificant kinds of charges or penalties. And so, you know, what we call for as people who are daily dealing with folks who are affected by this raid, both in the town here and the individuals who are immigrants or non-immigrants and immigrants who have suffered by this raid, is to beg, to say, can we have a discussion as a nation to say, is this the way to enforce our law?
Right. Yeah, we need that discussion as a nation. There's no doubt about it. And let me ask you, Jens, mm-hmm. what's fair here?
What's fair?
Right. What's fair?
In terms of
everything.
In terms of everything.
All that we've talked about, right.
A lot of people are calling for AgriProf to throw the book at them. And, I mean, so far, I believe the district attorney's office and ICE, when they say they're going after that, I mean, like I mentioned earlier, they're still doing grand jury testimony. It's inherently unfair because it's so much harder to go after the employers when a lot of times they're the ones encouraging people to cross the border. And at the same time, they're the ones with the lawyers who are being prosecuted under laws that have a higher burden of proof. The workers are low-hanging fruit, and it's easy to grab them. Meanwhile, the ones who are enabling everything, a lot of times can get off or get off easy.
Mm-hmm. David, same question to you. What's fair?
I don't know that there's anything fair about the experience that we have seen here. You know, it's hard to sometimes to kind of step back when you're dealing day in and day out with people's destroyed lives and for the community here. It isn't fair to take one of the, you know, there's not a lot of communities in rural America that can say that they're growing, flourishing, and strengthening. And that's what was happening in Postville until May 12th. In one day, this community went back significantly, as you indicated in the introduction to the program. The principal of the school here at the middle school and elementary school said in one interview that he has spent most of his educational career in this place trying to teach a child is a child, and to integrate the community in the way that Postville has been held to have done. And in one day, he was forced to go classroom to classroom and segregate his kids based basically on their last name and their heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And to take them all out, because he did not know which of these kids, if they're documented or not, and which of those kids had parents who would not be home at the end of the day.
Mm.
And so to be set back that way is not fair. It's not fair to these kids. One of the kids in this group, I mean, a four-year-old kid, a couple of days ago as I was leaving from here from Postville, there was a small airplane flying about, and the kid looked up in horror, looked at me, and ran to her mother, afraid. That kind of fear, you know, permeates our kids here, whether they are U.S. born or not.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the kids who have been here for generations, children of farmers in this community, were afraid and continue some of them to be, can they take my parents? They don't understand why these other people they've known as friends and relatives and have played with, why their parents disappeared overnight.
More phone calls in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our lines are all filled, but you could send an email if you'd like to do that. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We have two guests with us this hour, David Vasquez, who is campus pastor at Luther College and is coordinating legal advice for those who have been rounded up and those who are in prison and those who are wearing monitoring devices. Also joining us is Jens Manuel Krogstad, staff writer for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, and has done a great job of documenting all that's been going on in Postville. So we'll be back to you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Jane Mayer will be joining us, author of the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. The Dark Side is the name of the book. She is the co-author of two best-selling and critically acclaimed narrative nonfiction books, Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984 to 1988, and Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. She is a Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting. Back to your phone calls now as we continue this elaborate and sad story from Postville, Iowa. And our next caller is Vicki from Mount Horeb, but originally from Postville. Hi, Vicki.
Hello. I did grow up in Postville. I graduated in 1970 from Postville High School and still go back regularly because my mother still lives in that area. And I guess I'd like to offer an observation and sort of a curiosity as to the buildings and the houses and such in Postville that are being bought up by the Jewish community. Whenever something comes up for sale, it seems like it's been purchased by the Hasidic Jews, many of which are just sitting there vacant. The Postville Mercury Ford dealer, for instance, has been purchased by them, been sitting there vacant ever since, which is now years. And, you know, just wondering, you know, I think I probably feel the same anger that a lot of the callers have been expressing against the firm itself, because it seems to be business as usual, and my understanding is that lots of other workers are now being bussed into Postville regularly, where are they coming from? And, you know, you see here in the community, you know, there's whites, there's blacks, there's all sorts of people coming in. Nobody really knows where they're coming from. How are they still operating?
That's a good question. Jens?
A lot of them are day laborers. A few of them are homeless people coming. I know a couple weeks ago they were coming, majority of them from Texas. They were being bussed up, and the plant is operating at half capacity from what I understand. They're just running one shift. And they can't, and a lot of the workers, the new workers there, they come with a lot of social service needs. There's been a lot of residents say the town has changed since the new workers came. They say they've seen a lot more public drunkenness. They've seen a lot and all the effects of that, fights, public fights and things like that. And they don't like the change. They want their old workers back who had families and had family values, they tell me. And as far as the Jewish ownership, I mean I know the largest landlord in the town is Jewish, and he has something like 120, 130 properties. So yeah, there's no doubt that they are a huge part of the community.
I think if I can just say a couple of brief things here.
Yes.
You know, I think that they do what the caller refers to and really has put her finger on is that, as someone that grew up in Postville, is to say, you know, what is the future for this community? And again, to raise the question about the effectiveness or the impact, the cost, not only financial, but also human cost to a community of a rate like this. You know, the workers are coming. Of all the workers that came initially in the first couple of weeks, not a single one of them remains, pretty much. You know, so it's a much more trenchant community coming and leaving. For folks who aren't familiar with Postville, there's no way to get to Postville but to be brought here or taken, you know, or go away in a car. There is no public transportation of any sort. Most of the media that has come to cover the situation here, honestly, have gotten lost on their way here.
Oh, my.
We are really isolated. So when people come from cities, from larger cities, workers are coming from California, Chicago, New York, larger areas around Iowa. The makeup, the racial and ethnic background of them vary significantly on their needs and situations. We are seeing people daily as we are trying to support those affected by the raid here at this very small church, where we're kind of working out of. People are coming in who are new workers with very difficult circumstances and situations with great need. And so the needs in the community are huge and are overwhelming the infrastructure of a community that doesn't have those resources to provide for them. And so you've shifted from a established, growing community, vibrant, to one that is back again, you know, talking about returning 20 years back for the community in terms of the initial round of making it, welcoming new people here. And there's some apprehension about that, especially when you know that you're living in an environment where a federal policy can basically
sure.
destroy all the work that you do over 20 years. I mean, the town is reeling from that and wondering what their future
sure.
will look like.
And it's also an indication of the number of people in this country who are in great need, who are willing to travel to this place that is so hard to get to and have their own troubled pasts, and they need jobs.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the new workers are not staying. I mean, within 5 minutes of arriving in Postville a couple weeks ago, I ran into three guys who were waiting for a bus to go back to Texas because they said the pay was too low, the conditions were too tough, and these were veterans of the meatpacking industry who said they'd never worked in conditions like that, and they weren't going to put up with it, so they're heading back to Texas.
And that's what we're hearing as well from a lot of the people who are coming. And again, the difficulty is then they're coming and going and coming and going, and so that generates a lot of anxiety for people. You know, this is not the image of the melting pot of the American dream. This is a place where you take a wide variety of people without any infrastructure or any attention to how to help. You know, this is not a town that has the social services and the educational resources to kind of help a community incorporate successfully a large group of people, and so it's really kind of creating some difficulty and creating issues that were addressed initially here, and that the community had to figure out a way to
right.
deal with.
And you're having a lot of people from the country come in on July 27, aren't you, to draw attention to all that's going on in Postville?
Yes, we are organizing an interfaith prayer service that will be in Hebrew, English, and Spanish that will begin this event. It will be on the 27th of July on a Sunday at 1 p.m. here, beginning at St. Bridget's Catholic Church, which is in the, in town. Again, Postville's real small, so it's easy to find if anyone would like to come join us. We'll begin at 1 o'clock with this interfaith service. There will be representatives from a wide variety of organizations and places. We're expecting people from Chicago, Minneapolis, kind of like the regional area, and other cities in Iowa as well. And their event is bringing Jewish organizations, Catholic organizations, Lutheran churches, and other community organizers around the region. And the intent is to begin with this prayer service, to do a walk through town, and then also just to express solidarity with the people who are affected by this raid, to make sure that their stories are known and their voices heard, as well as trying to also call for an evaluation of these raids and their impact on communities, and to call, as many people have for many years been doing, to call for an immigration reform that, as we continue to work with laws that were established in, 20 years ago, our country's changed significantly. The issues of immigration in Iowa are very different than they are in the border states.
Let's go to Jean from Eau Claire. Hi, Jean.
Hi. As I listen to this scenario, all sides and aspects, I think to myself, what is wrong with this picture, and the way that the language and the terms that we're utilizing to define it? And I find one term to summarize this situation, and it's modernized slavery. I mean, everybody's hurting. Who is the person or persons or structure that is benefiting the most from this situation? Because it's definitely not the immigrants. And I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks, Jean. Thanks for the call. Is that what you would call it, David?
I wasn't able to hear very well the term that she used.
Modernized slavery.
Unfortunately, I think that's apt for the kinds of stories we're hearing from individuals. Again, if you think, I think of indentured slavery, most of the people who have a history of immigration, which is most everybody in the United States, can remember either from history or from family stories of, loved ones who came, lied about their age, to be able to work early on,
sure.
And came as with a huge fee that they had to kind of spend the first several years of their life paying. That's what these folks are doing. I mean, they're coming. They're paying $10,000 a person to come here. If there was a process for them to do, they would do it. If they're willing to walk 2 months and pay $10,000 to come and clean meat for us, I think that they would follow any procedure existing that would allow them a legal way to come. And so what you have is the intimidation that they are subjected to, and again, not only in this meatpacking plant, but I think this is an issue in many industries around the country. They have, and the raids create a panic that makes them even less willing to speak. A couple nights ago, I was putting my son to bed, and he chose for his reading nighttime book, Horton Hears a Who. I ended the book in tears, trying to imagine, can we hear these little people? Can anybody believe? And being in Postal Iowa in the middle of, you know, oftentimes you could say nowhere, it's hard for these voices to be heard.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for being with us. We're interested in following this story, so we'll call you again.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
Thank you.
I appreciate your attention to it.
Yeah, we appreciate having you on with us. David Vasquez, who is pastor minister at Luther College campus, and he's coordinating the legal advice for people who are spread out all over the country. I didn't realize they're everywhere. Jens Manuel Krogstad is the staff writer for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. And again, they said that on July 27, an interfaith prayer in March calling for immigration reform, if anything points to a need for it. It's the story that's coming out of Postville, Iowa. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and to John Treader for on-air production in Milwaukee. We have news coming up and we'll return with another hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.